I'm Nell Frizzell, and this is The Panic Years. When I was 28, everyone around me seemed to be getting married, getting promotions, buying houses, and having babies. I was single, redundant, and living with my mum. At the time, I thought it was a private crisis. Now I understand it was just my panic years, and that is what this podcast is all about. I'm in an orchard. Can you hear that bird? It's amazing. Blackbird, maybe? Having a go? I'm sitting next to some apple trees that actually seeded themselves here many years ago because it used to be a rubbish dump. And the pips managed to sort of seed themselves into the ground after being thrown out as apple cores with all the rest of other people's crap. My boyfriend now reads local history leaflets, which is how I know so much about the trees around here. This week, my son had his preschool jabs and MMR, which you get when you're three. And God, I just love vaccines. I love them. Vaccinate against everything, I say. Vaccinate against diseases, heartbreak, bad fashion decisions. I've also had my COVID vaccine, which is frankly incredible. I was so grateful afterwards that I gave the nurse a bunch of daffodils that I'd brought along. And then she got so overwhelmed that we basically, between the two of us, forgot to give me the card with all the information on. And I had to loop round this whole big sort of queuing system to ask for it and the leaflet, which looked like I was just like a shameless vaccine jumping VIP, which I'm absolutely not. But God, it's amazing. I felt rough for that night, but I now am sort of cloaked in a blanket of protection, which is amazing. That's my week's injection news for you all. My guest this week is the journalist, writer, social media editor, and South London Amazonian, Kat Brown. I first met Kat Brown back when we were both single and in the, let me say, throwing mud at the wall stage of the panic years. In the years since, Kat's just become one of those brilliantly open, thoughtful, honest people on social media that almost make the whole social media enterprise worthwhile. During our chat, we spoke about infertility, what happens when timelines don't go according to plan, and what it's like when IVF proves unsuccessful. I would say that if you're in the midst of fertility treatment, this conversation will feel really important and probably very relatable, but it might also be quite difficult at times. So please stick around after the interview, because I'll be talking to the fertility counsellor Tracy Sainsbury to get some really helpful insight and advice on all of this. In the meantime, enjoy. How are you? And how is your body?
My body is filled with Ben and Jerry's, as it has been for, I mean, I'd like to say probably about the last 14 months since I gave up drinking alcohol, but realistically for the last 38 years, probably. Body, pretty good. I was born with something called bilateral hip dysplasia, which basically means shallow hip sockets, which didn't really affect me for absolutely years, beyond the fact my parents had to like wrap me up in double nappies and stuff. But a few years ago, I got this obsession with running because I read Alexandra Hemmingsley's amazing book, Running Like a Girl, and was like, yes, I want to fulfill my thwarted childhood cross-country hatred destiny to run. And I ended up running a marathon.
Oh, casual. No big thing.
I was so terrified all the time that I was training for running anything that I thought if I took it too seriously and did any cross-training at all, I would just stop. And basically all that has done has exacerbated problems in my hips and quads and everything. So I'm basically just like a sort of marionette puppet. So basically just trying to do physio.
I'm imagining you walk like John Wayne.
I wish. It's more, I'm walking absolutely fine and then I just start limping and look like an incredibly tall Dickensian orphan, which always unnerves the people that I'm with. So trying to do physio and trying to do physio on your own at home is the most boring thing in the world ever. So I'm just sporadically going for walks.
I know exactly what you mean about the magic of running. I refused to buy any proper running clothes for about 4 or 5 months. So I would just run around Victoria Park in a pair of plimsolls and my pajama bottoms, because I thought that if I got any gear,
I would instantly become a total toss bag and I'd stop running. So I managed to do myself and managed to do my feet quite a damage by basically flapping around in sort of loungewear for months and months. I wanted you on the podcast for a long time, and I, like, as soon as I was writing the book, you were one of the people in my head. Do you remember what you were doing? Were you in a sort of panic years situation, or did yours come later?
My panic years, and I love that you defined that, because it is absolutely the case for that late 20s, early 30s period. My panic years had basically begun in childhood. I was moved up a year when I was 7, so moved up a school year. And because in the late 80s, as this was, doctors basically were of the attitude that either you gave tall children growth hormones to stunt their growth, or if they were, I don't know, knew their 7 times table as well as their 6 times table, you just chucked them up a school year and had done with it.
Wow.
And so whilst I could cope with the work and everything, I instantly lost this key social year of coping. And so I basically just turned to books, anything that I got out of the library, which could be Enid Blyton's school stories to Ruby Ferguson's Jill's pony stories. And I got a lot of my moral compass from books about kids in the 1950s, written by women in their 30s, 40s and upwards.
That is tough to feel like you were already a step out of time from the age of 7. And was that a sort of characteristic feeling, do you think, in your 20s and 30s, that you thought, I'm not quite on the groove that my contemporaries are in?
I had ingrained in me very, not even strong opinions, but I just knew, for example, that I could never wear that and I could never say that and I could never pretend to think that or whatever, which, I mean, again, is very typical teenage thinkery. But I know that my life would have been significantly easier if I had just, I probably, you know, shut up more and just worn more chinos and polos. Oh my God, especially when we moved to the country.
If you just doused yourself in Charlie Red and kept your mouth shut, things would have been a lot easier.
Exactly. But 20s and 30s, I think, was tricky because I went to university when I was 17.
When we were talking about you coming on the podcast, you said something really interesting, which is that you wondered how much of your attitude towards your career and relationships and potential motherhood was affected by ADHD without necessarily understanding it at the time.
One of the reasons that I was like, oh my God, yes, when I unearthed through women talking about it on social media and articles about women being underdiagnosed and that sort of thing, it made me realise that I hadn't just spent like the last 20 odd years being really greedy in terms of mental health problems. It was just that ADHD has so many comorbidities. And by that, I mean illnesses, syndromes, all sorts of things that sort of overlap. But the overarching umbrella, if you like, is ADHD. So when I was 10, I was diagnosed with petit mal epilepsy, which is basically absence seizures, which is, I was just like, that's totally random. Was it because I fell off my bike and hit my face? And they were like, that's not how epilepsy works, Catherine. But it turns out that childhood epilepsy is like the biggest comorbidity with ADHD. And then on top of that, I had, you know, God, it feels like Joseph and his amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat. I had anxiety and depression and binge eating disorder and binge drank alcohol. All sorts of things that sort of came under it.
You'd really collected the set.
Yeah, literally joined the dots. One of the major things for me had always been racing thoughts. And so when I described that terror that I felt at university whenever I was on my own, you know, especially at night when I couldn't sleep, couldn't concentrate or couldn't relax, almost as though I was in sort of pause mode, waiting for another human being to sort of wake me up so that we could go and do something together. That was, it's just exhausting for like decades, basically. And I just thought it was completely normal for people to feel like that. And I didn't realise that it wasn't, and that other people could go and look at something without their brain suddenly immediately sparking off in 900 different directions, none of which were necessarily connected to what they were looking at. You know, not necessarily being able to concentrate on a film or a book or something.
When you're struggling to concentrate on a single book or a single film, when you're presented with such a huge global binary, such as having a baby, not having a baby, or this job or not this job or this relationship or not this relationship, what happens? What did you, in your 20s, what would you do when confronted with those thoughts? Did you push them away or did you spark through all the possibilities? What happened?
In terms of jobs, I knew very, very, very strongly that I wanted to write. I wanted to be a journalist. I wanted to entertain people specifically. This is also largely because the other thing that I wanted to do was to be an actress. And at that point, there was no Gwendolyn Christie. There were no tall actresses. And I had enough, I mean, as minimal sense as I had in my 20s, I had enough to be able to go, oh, I don't want to waste all that time and then not get any parts. My parents would send me off to sort of like insight into management courses and shorthand and secretarial courses as a backup, in inverted commas, which is very kind. I didn't learn anything that I've ever used since. I just knew that I wanted to cling on as much as possible into journalism, which actually turned out to be the number one skill.
So in this drive, you had this very clear drive about the kind of work that you were built for and you wanted to be doing. At any point in your 20s and increasingly your 30s, were you thinking about how that work would intersect with having a baby or having a relationship, or were you not thinking about that at that point?
I was very keen on having a relationship, largely because I was convinced that it would act as some kind of, I don't know, cellophane, if you like, for how defective I thought I was as a person.
Okay.
And I thought that if I could tick off all of these life things, that it would make me more acceptable to people. Unfortunately, all I discovered was that, you know, a relationship is like a friendship, but with, well, at the beginning, quite a lot of sex, and then probably later on, about as much sex as you'd have in a regular friendship. And I also realised that nobody gave a crap about where I worked. Even when I was working at like really, you know, glamorous and exciting places. I think my 20s was very good for making me realise that literally nobody cares apart from you about anything. And the only time that people do care is if you're confident, in which case they will feed off it in some way.
I used to jokingly say that my entire career was the sort of accidental byproduct of just trying to have sex with people. I thought that if I sort of walked into a bar and said to someone very good looking, oh, actually, I'm due to interview Yoko Ono next week, they'd be like, oh my God, you are the most scintillating, beautiful woman I've ever met. Why don't we move in together and have some children? What actually happened was they'd say, who? Or, oh, right. Or, it's not so much a question, but how did you get into blah, 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 blah? I thought people in newspapers, everyone would want to sleep with people in newspapers, but it apparently doesn't work like that.
But your question about the child thing, when I briefly went to an all-girls school when I was seven, it was sort of drummed into us, not quite in a Miss Jean Brodie way, but that we could do anything and that we should aim to do anything. But that really, really stuck with me. And similarly, my mum was very much like, if I got pregnant when I was young, that would basically be the end of my life.
Oh, and that you might get pregnant at the drop of a hat. That was, I think, our sex education was like, be very, very careful because potent sperm will whip up your trouser leg when you're not looking and just doing up your shoes. And that's it. You're 16 and you're pregnant.
Absolutely. And women are fertile at all times, just literally just like a big fertile buzzer is sitting over our heads, which is amazing because considering they took all that time with like polystyrene penises and PSE lessons and they just never took any time. I think probably because they must have been worried that if women knew how their fertility cycle worked, that they might actually use it and then have safer sex, which in turn meant having sex at all, which actually in my case was really not something to worry about for quite some time. But then as I got into my 20s, I'd always had this sort of thought that I suppose probably from my thrusting girls' school that I briefly went to, but also the luxury and the privilege that I had of having a private education up until I fled to my wonderful sixth form college. And I was incredibly lucky and I knew that I was being invested in, if you like. I mean, I didn't see it that way when I was a kid, but I knew that I was incredibly lucky and that I would have to sort of pay this back, if you like, with a really good, stable job. And then I entered the marketplace and I kept being made redundant. And I just was like, OK, well, look, we'll hold on for a bit and we'll see if we can stay in a job for, I don't know, longer than a year and a half or something. And I was in a job for about 4 years. And unfortunately, it was exactly the sort of stable, not easy. I found it quite, I was very spoiled and very lucky, but I found it quite easy and quite unchallenging. And I was a bit like, oh God, I'm 28. Do I want to be here forever?
Oh, 28. Here it comes, riding over the hill.
You're like, no, you know, I'm going to be 30 soon, which means I'm probably going to be dead anyway. So, you know, I need to go and do a challenging thing. So I went and did a challenging thing and then was made redundant exactly a year afterwards. So by about, I was coming up for 32, 33, I'd just got married to an amazing man who I'd met first off at university when I was 17.
Wow.
And then mercifully had not seen at all during my 20s. So he couldn't see what a massive dickhead I was. He just saw that when I was 17. So anyway, we'd got married and basically just been like, oh, thank God we found each other. Literally the best thing that has ever happened to me was meeting my husband, and I'm lucky for that every bloody day. And then shortly after that, we thought, I was just like, oh, well, I guess we start trying for a baby now. I was so put out. I was put out because A, I knew that was what was expected of me. B, I knew that I wanted to have a family, this sort of amorphous concept. And I knew that I wanted to have children. It was just really unfortunate that at this present moment in time, I'd just been made redundant for like the third time. Just felt like my life wasn't really happening. I hadn't really achieved anything. What I realise now, actually, is crucially, it wasn't I hadn't achieved anything. It's that I was still an anxious, confused, deeply worried, non-Zen person. if I'd known how my brain worked in a better way, rather than, you know, going to therapy, having antidepressants, and then being like, oh God, it's still not working, must be me. If I'd managed to sort of iron all that out, then A, I would be a completely different person to the person I am now. But then also, I might have been able to cope with any situation that I was in and been like, this is fine, we're going to have kids now and it'll be great because I'm ready to do that. But I wasn't, and I was a total mess.
There's the fallacy that you have to have your life sorted, or you have to succeed to a certain level before you can start having children, is something that I felt really intrinsically, and it was like a burden that I sort of carried around in my womb and in my fingers, that like, oh my God, I've got to reach some sort of level of success before I do the next thing on this ladder. And I genuinely can't think of any men in my life who were working under that same delusion. Like that they felt that they either had a deadline by which they had to achieve something, that there was a sort of fertility deadline ticking away in their body that they had to listen to, and or that their success couldn't come at their own pace. And I find it so upsetting, and because it's so familiar to me, that idea that you have to almost tick off a checklist of acceptable successes before you're allowed to look inside your body and see what's going on and what you want to do and question your interest in motherhood and all of that sort of stuff, because it just feels like a sort of gendered imbalance. And if this isn't on too on the nose, when you hear about someone like that who got pregnant accidentally the first time they had sex with their partner, is there a bit of you, as someone who didn't get pregnant accidentally the first time you had sex with your husband, is there a bit of you that sort of goes, ouch? Or do you feel something that I can't even imagine?
My husband and I, after trying for 3-4 years, had 2 cycles of IVF in 2019. And both times, all my eggs came back immature, which basically meant they couldn't be fertilised. I was just like, oh, this is, nobody told me about this. This wasn't in any of the books.
So this is the undiagnosed, there's no reason that we can find, but you're just not going to get pregnant. Is it that?
No, I had amazing AMH levels. All of my tests came back really well. My follicles were all developing nicely. I'd had a laparoscopy and a hysteroscopy a few years ago, which is basically where they flush out your tubes and check your womb. And I had a couple of little things there, but they weren't like big things that needed to be, that nothing was being blocked, basically.
Just some raisins, blue tack, staples, a little, yes, some spare change, one of those little IKEA pencils, just stuff that you know.
Oh God, always. it just didn't work for us. And I suppose one of the things that made us feel vaguely cheery about the whole thing, in so much as you can, which is, spoiler alert, not at all. So my reaction to, like, people I don't know getting pregnant, I don't really have one. I had a brilliant conversation earlier this week with, like, the only really close friend that I have who is also going through something very similar. And we drove to a car park in Wimbledon and sat side by side in our cars like we were spies about to swap a package. We just sat there and gossiped.
You were dogging, and I don't know why you're why you've come up with this huge elaborate excuse for it, but fine, carry on.
She said this amazing thing, because I was saying, I feel so guilty for the fact that my feelings about becoming a mother were always so complex and so confused, and they weren't just like, I look forward to holding a baby in my arms, and it was more like, what about my career? I have no stability. Am I going to ruin a child? So all of those feelings, and then obviously, you know, this amazing treatment turning out not to be so amazing for us. But then also having the complexity that I've literally never been pregnant, and then feeling even more guilty about the fact that my husband and I bought a house because we thought we'd have kids in it. And so we've been able to spend lockdown in a house rather than a flat, whilst, you know, loads of people with families have been cramped up in spaces that are absolutely not intended to keep people locked away all the time. And then also the extra guilt of the fact that I haven't had to homeschool, and, you know, and I haven't, for example, had a newborn that hasn't been able to socialise with other kids and isn't therefore completely terrified every time it sees another human being. But then, so the guilt of all of those conflicting feelings, and we haven't even got to the point about the fact that raising children is really bloody hard. And I see that in my in-laws and all my friends and everything. But then it's just the little holes get through and you're just like, I know all that, but it's just... still feel really shit sometimes.
Of course.
And it comes out of nowhere. It just comes out of nowhere. Like now, I'm just like, I was totally fine, and now I'm suddenly like, oh, I'm not very fine. But it's just so waves.
And it's not in any way the same, but that feeling of it sort of accidentally slipping through the net when you're not looking. I still occasionally, I really, really wanted to have another baby, and my partner absolutely was determined that we weren't going to have any more children. And just occasionally I hear myself explaining that to someone and I can't get the words out. I just say, well, I really wanted one, but I'm not going to have any more children. And there were moments when I was like unwinding things I'd knitted for my son to re-knit them smaller for someone else's baby, because I was like, I don't need to keep hold of these. I'm not going to have any more children. You just think, this is really unfair and I'm really sad about it.
Any horrible feeling that you have is valid. Any infertility sucks ass. I mean, I am incredibly grateful, and again, feeling even more guilty that I've, you know, never been pregnant, because it's also meant that I've never had the horror of a miscarriage. But I was sitting in the car with my friend, carefully not dogging. Well, that's what we say anyway. And she said this amazing thing, which is basically just that, because I was saying that I felt so guilty not to be more consistent in my grief for something that didn't even exist. And she was just like, but the thing is that the feelings that we are going through with this, there are so, so many nuanced and complex feelings that they are just going to randomly pop up out of nowhere. I mean, like, I was basically in tears like 3 minutes ago, and now I feel fine. I've just got a box of tissues next to me. And it's just the fact that those feelings just sort of erupt almost like spots, and then you pop them and then hopefully they disappear. That's a horrible analogy. Just forget that I said that. Bearing that.
You occasionally just splatter the sebum of your own discomfort on the mirror of life.
But it is just I wish that I could be more consistent for my friends and for my family, because every now and then there will be things that knock me for six. Like a couple of years ago, it was the sight of somebody popping into the room, and I didn't know they were pregnant, and they were very visibly pregnant, and I literally just had to run upstairs and sob. But it's just these little random things that take you by surprise. And sometimes something that did take you by surprise before doesn't. And it's just so unpredictable. And for somebody that needs consistency to remain on a vaguely even keel, this is absolutely not the one to give me like a balanced sort of mental load. You know, celebrities or people getting pregnant easily or whatever. I think you don't always see yourself in those people. Like, for example, I think Chrissy Teigen is an absolute legend. I mean, I could just end that sentence there, but also in terms of talking about IVF and also talking about stillbirth, even though we've had similar experiences, her experiences are not my experiences. And part of the reason that I've, you know, written a couple of pieces about what I've been through is because I'm not a celebrity. Nobody knows who I am. And I think that's really important, because I know that certainly when I was stopping drinking, I found it really helpful to know about famous people who, you know, hadn't drunk for years or had just decided it wasn't worth it or whatever. But the people that really helped me were just like, you know, average random people, such as I would have met at a launch party or in a bar or something, just go, oh, mate, me too. Can't do it anymore. Too many consequences.
I think there's something joyful, if that's not the wrong word, about something that you think is very personal and poignant and shameful actually being presented to you as incredibly prosaic and everyday. You know, when you realise that everyone around you is having something on that wavelength of either sadness or jealousy or envy or disappointment or fear or whatever. And that actually it's really common. It's as common as heartbreak. It's as common as anxiety about, look, you know, excitement for a job interview, about first date jitters. The sort of the disappointed bloody gusset is so prosaic and so normal that pretty much everyone who has a period that you've met will have it at some point in their life. Even if they are determinedly don't want children, there'll be a weird month where they are sad that they're not pregnant, and you can't fight it. It's a weird thing, and you can't judge yourself for it, and you can't expect yourself to be consistent all the time. Terry White is brilliant about this, about how she for years and decades was absolutely sure she didn't want to have a baby, and then for a couple of years just really did want a baby, and then it went again and she didn't want a baby anymore, and then she got pregnant. It's like, don't expect us to have a sort of binary view on this, because it's much more complicated. And like you say, I want to dig into what you were saying about how the thing that didn't exist, that's not a binary either. You're not pregnant or not pregnant. You don't have a baby or there is no baby. There is I imagine, a greyer area there for you.
Oh, hugely. And I think also this comes into point when you know people who completely inadvertently name their kids a name that you had in mind for your future kid. I mean, to be honest, in the past, I've had endless joy reading furious Mumsnet lists about how their sister-in-law stole the name Olivia and she knew that I wanted it. And then actually, it is a little bit less funny most of the time. But I think it's this weird thing. Like, never having been pregnant, I've never had that kid, that person that could be inside me. I see them in my head. And the feeling that I had when a name was used or when I think about these is because I think the big form of this kind of grief is because it's a timeline that will never exist. There will never be a timeline in which me and my husband have children. And he would have been an amazing dad. And I would have been probably quite a shit mum. I've had so much therapy that I'd hope I'd have been a less shit mum than
you
I would always
have,
worried
You
I
would have be. Made the best of a terrible job.
Oh my God, yes, literally. And it is also kind of brilliant that whenever we're at a family gathering or something, and everything's just slightly kicking off later in the day near to bedtime, we can just run away with minimal consequences, and that is incredibly lucky. But again, that is all part of the up and down.
It's a very, very complicated thing. I remember a friend of mine saying when she was pregnant and then she lost her baby, the alternative timeline that you're talking about, she then knew people who got pregnant and had babies that around basically that their babies were being born before her baby would have been born, and feeling so gazumped by that you know, someone had kind of beaten you twice, and just feeling very, you know, in a way that is absolutely not their fault, incredibly angry and envious.
Yeah, and you get it. I think you get it in different stages of intensity of feelings. So like one of my oldest friends, I remember her telling me that she and her husband were going to try for another baby, and I was thinking, oh God, well, you know, me and my husband are hoping to try for that time too. Oh my God. And then obviously just disappeared off in a timeline in which our children were born at the same time and they grew up and they were best friends and all that sort of stuff. And And so when every now and then, and it certainly doesn't happen every time I think about this gorgeous kid or even see them, I'm like, oh yeah, if all had gone to plan, our kid would have been that age. So anyway, I was talking to my therapist about this, and she got me to do some really helpful stuff. So imagining that my kids were sitting in the empty chair across from me and talking to them, which I think is quite a common thing, but which was really helpful here. She also suggested that I write them a letter, and I haven't managed to do that yet. I'm just doing everything that I can to put it off, really. But then she also asked if I would like to give them a funeral. And it was almost like the permission that I'd been looking for to do this completely, I suppose, ridiculous thing. Because how can you give a funeral to people that were, you know, they never even became zygotes, you know, sort of thing. But I suppose, again, it's that putting a lid on that timeline. And I don't know when I'm going to be able to do it, but...
Yeah, I think the whole thing is so bizarre and abstract after a certain point. And actually, the idea of having a sort of farewell sense of ritual around something that even never had a tangible form is no more weird to me than the idea that you have a tangible embryo sitting somewhere. Like, the whole thing is fairly abstract. And actually, as someone who's been pregnant, that's fairly abstract too. You know, I spent 9 months thinking, actually, this is a huge hoax. I read a lot about phantom pregnancies in the royal family, to the point where in my first midwife appointment, when they showed me the scan, I thought, I bet this is a video that they show to everyone, like the moon landings. This is just the same video they show everybody to make you think there's a baby in there. But I don't think there's a baby in there. It certainly seems unlikely. So I think we need to let go of the idea that there is a tangible or real sense of pregnancy, and then there can be a real sense of loss. It's all as emotionally valid, I think, for everybody.
Part of that comes from more people talking about it. Going back to what you were saying about taking your son's socks apart to knit new ones, I don't think there's anything wrong with actually just going, do you know what, I'm not going to, and I'm going to hold these socks and thank them for what they've done for me and for my son. And I'm going to put them in this box, and then I'm going to, I don't know, float them down a river and give them a Viking send-off.
Viking funeral. It's always, my mind always goes to a Viking funeral. It'd be so...
I just love fire, Nell. We just need to set fire to more things.
Set fire to it all. I did want to, for people that missed it, this was probably one of the few times that I have actually cried and laughed and snorted while reading Twitter in the last few years, which is the time where you rickrolled a certificate frame. Can you please tell us the story of what happened there?
Oh, God, yes. So this was about, it must have been about 2-3 days after our second cycle of IVF had come to naught. And I pretty much knew then I was just not going to get pregnant. And so when we went to our sort of consultant's appointment on Friday, and I hate these appointments because they're never with the nice, friendly doctors that you've got to know. They're always with some cold man in a horrible suit sitting there with his bad glasses. So anyway, we went to the hospital, and I didn't want any of my regular clothes to sort of be affected by going to this appointment. So I wore one of my Christmas jumpers. We went to the co-op. I actually still love this Christmas jumper, so actually that's fine. But I'm quite sensitive or, I don't know, weird about lasting effects and stuff, so I just didn't want to look at a jumper that I loved and be like, oh god, misery IVF jumper, blurg. So anyway, we took a load of boxes of Cadbury's Heroes for the staff. We did not give one to the horrible consultant, but because the unit was so brand new, something that I'd been fixating on during all my appointments was that they had all these like hung certificate frames, like A4 size, but they were completely empty. And I was absolutely desperate to put something in. So I got my husband to print out a picture, like a lovely, very tasteful black and white illustration of Rick Astley. And then we gave the chocolates to the receptionists, and we returned all of our medicine so that it could go to the students and for other people that need to practice stabbing needles and that sort of thing. And then I whipped off one of the frames, went to the loo, put Rick in it, and then came back and hung it on the wall. And just thought, do you know what? That is something nice that's come out of this appointment. We'd left saying thank you to all of the amazing staff who are so, so bloody incredible. And we left that lovely facility and we left it there with a lovely, poignant artwork of Rick Astley.
Hello again. I hope you found Kat as brilliant and open as I did. As I say there, sometimes we find it really difficult to talk about fertility or even just to look at it head on when it's happening. So I was lucky enough to speak to Tracy Sainsbury, a fertility counsellor and author of Making Friends with Your Fertility, to find out why this subject can feel so sensitive and how we can best cope with those feelings. My first question, I suppose, is some people won't know what a fertility counsellor is. You know, they won't have come across one and maybe their friends haven't mentioned it, even if they're seeing one. So can you just tell us a little bit about what you do in your work and the kind of people that you see?
Yeah, many counsellors will work with fertility issues, but enhanced fertility training just helps to really reinforce what goes on consciously and unconsciously when we're trying to conceive, because, you know, over 40% of people having fertility treatment can experience suicidal thoughts and over 80% depression and anxiety.
My goodness, really, 40% will have suicidal thoughts?
More. Fertility wow. Network UK did a big survey on the emotional impact of fertility stuff back in 2016, and it just reinforced the levels of emotional distress.
So I suppose when people come to you, they are at like a real high point of sort of anxiety and indecision or hope or distress. Like, that is that what can you offer to people other than validation of their feelings? What do you sort of see your role being?
It's an odd one because people come at all points,
right?
So many clinics have mandatory or routine implications counselling ahead of any donor conception, or if somebody's egg sharing, or if it's a donor donating eggs or sperm. So counselling at that point helps to myth bust, future proof, prepare for the emotional roller coaster, takes the pressure off. There's that saying, it's what screws us up most in life is the vision in our head of how it should be.
Yeah, yeah.
So we take that pressure off. Our same-sex couples are harder on themselves than any heterosexual couple.
Really? Why is that?
Well, if we think of a heterosexual couple, they've been trying for a while often. They give themselves permission to be peed off, angry and upset.
Right, right, yeah.
Whereas a same-sex couple who've planned for it, prepared for it, saved for it, there's often that sense of, right, we should be grateful, we're ready, we know what we're doing. So it's that sense of how things should be. And then if you have a wobble, if you have a panic, the minute the trauma of treatment becomes a reality, there's very much the potential to be too hard on yourself and feel the helplessness that you can't support each other in the way you used to when you weren't in treatment.
You've just used the phrase, the trauma of treatment. And, you know, I have a few people close to me who are either undergoing IVF at the moment or have. And it's a heavy undertaking. You know, it's hard work. Do you have any advice for people to prepare for that or to kind of adjust their expectations for the fact that it might be quite difficult?
Acknowledge it's a trauma.
Mm-hmm.
So we're mid-pandemic,
yeah,
when everyone's foundation's a bit shaky because no one can predict what's going to happen. So when we think of fertility treatment, even not being able to go into the clinic with your partner for embryo transfer, you know, there's so much going on. But what happens in our unconscious at a time when there's a trauma, especially a fertility-related trauma, because it doesn't work on a timeline, it's just like there's a melting pot of all the shit we've experienced through life, and somebody lobs in a big trauma magnet.
Yeah.
Everything that's been life, relationship, family impacting with no control is attracted to this trauma magnet, and then it gets lobbed on us the minute we're told you've got to be zen-like, calm and really positive. Don't get stressed.
That magnet analogy is so useful for me because, yeah, I think that is what happens. It suddenly becomes a sort of touchstone for any self-criticism, trauma about your body, sort of misapprehension about your family, like difficulty in terms of relationships or all of that stuff. the physical side of IVF can be quite traumatic as well. You will go through physical discomfort. You will go through hormonal changes. Those things can have a massive impact on your mental health.
When somebody's going through IVF, the shock when they start taking the medication, I never expect you to conceive this way. If it's a second or later cycle, I thought it would have worked by now. I was super positive in the first cycle, now not so. If they've experienced pregnancy loss before, there's that sense of impending doom. It's never going to work, but I can't stop yet. So we just become way too hard on ourselves.
Yeah.
That emotional roller coaster, as high as you can go, woohoo, going to create new life. As low as you can go, barren, worthless, useless, what's the point? Any other situation in life, what we tend to do is if we're down, we have a boost. We'll do a bit of cognitive behavioural therapy and change the way we're thinking or challenge overwhelming thoughts. So if we're down, we have a boost. If we're getting carried away, if we're too high, we'll rein it in a bit. And we have karma in the middle. But frustratingly with fertility stuff, if we beat ourselves up and rein ourselves in, we don't have calm in the middle. We create a bloody great big pressure cooker and we're just constantly exhausted, knackered. We're walking on eggshells around ourselves.
There isn't a sort of equilibrium, because striving for equilibrium is just another way of flagellating yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. That sort of leads me on to something else I wanted to ask you, which is that, and I'm absolutely guilty of this, I'm sure, that people who are undergoing fertility treatment are told that having a positive mental attitude, keeping hopeful, you know, stay upbeat and your body will respond to your sort of positive mental leadership. I sort of think that can also be incredibly unhelpful, because then what if you don't become biologically pregnant? All your positive thinking has set you up for an even greater disappointment than if you had been realistic about the chances from the start.
If we could stress ourselves not pregnant, if we could send negative vibes to our endometrium, repel that embryo, I'm too stressed. If we think of the millions and millions of women who sadly experience unwanted pregnancies, My God, that would be amazing. We'd be all powerful beings if we could stop ourselves getting pregnant.
Yeah, through thought alone. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, it's so true that so often the sort of the momentum behind self-criticism is actually search for control. You know, if this is my fault, then I have in somehow had more control than if I have to admit it's total fluke or luck or beyond, you know, beyond something that can be physically or mentally predicted. Like so much of fertility is chance. And I think that's the thing that we're sort of really uncomfortable talking about. And I'm someone who biologically got pregnant, you know, spontaneously conceived. That's chance. But even within the realms of IVF, you're still dealing with chance, aren't you? And we hate chance. We hate chance.
More than that, though, eggs will do their damnedest not to give you an unhealthy pregnancy. So if an egg knows it's not going to be a healthy baby and says, you know, just what, forget it, sperm, don't bother, you know, we won't get pregnant, blooming marvellous. You know, it means your body's worked effectively. Yeah. But so often there's that sense of, I did something wrong. So it's that, actually, let's all have a bit more self-kindness and self-compassion and recognise we're doing what we're doing. And frustratingly, there is no guarantee of success. It's not about having a plan B, because we often can't make that plan B until we're ready. So if we have made a fixed plan, I'll do X, Y and Z and then go on to A, B and C. If we do X, Y, Z and then want to go back to X and start again, we beat ourselves up because we failed to stick to the plan. Right.
Yeah. I suppose you see people who are wondering at what point to quote unquote give up. And, you know, like you might have had five rounds of IVF or you might have, you know, been trying for 10 years. At what point do you say, that's enough, I'm not going to keep pursuing this?
You might not have had any IVF and have decided that's a step too far. Or you might have had one cycle and that's enough. And many people no, or one cycle is enough.
Good point. Very good point.
When you look on the forums, there will be people who've had 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 cycles. And what that can do is give a sense of reinforcing how weak you are if you choose not to carry on. I haven't got that strength. And actually, it's not a competition.
Yeah.
You stop and embrace an alternate nurturing option, whether that's self-nurturing, being involuntarily childless and that feeling 51% the right thing to do. Or or 51% exploring a different pathway to parenthood. If 49% is chubbing away in the background, but what about this, what about the other, should have done this, could have done that, but what the, this, that, then that's manageable to move forward on a different route.
So if you're just over halfway sure that you're doing something else, that that's enough to carry on trying something else?
50-50, we're knackered and we can't move. You know, I want to try again, but I'm not ready for a cycle. Yeah. I'm taking a break. You know, and you'll see people on the forums, I just needed to step back a bit, had a break, I'm back now ready to go. And they've rebuilt their robustness and resilience. Their, you know, their nurturing capacity is sufficient that they can cope with whatever happens next. If we're not there, we can't shift.
You know, all what we want to do is build up empathy with each other. But I think until people around me started having fertility treatment, it was like an unknown quantity. And so to be kind and gentle and supportive to people who are in it is really hard, because we don't think about what they're actually going through. We don't think about the needles and the hormones and the tiredness and all of that stuff.
And that's why it's really simple to support somebody going through fertility treatment. How are you doing? Tell me. Can't make it better, but I'm here to listen.
That's really good advice. I'm just going to start asking you, like, individually how to help every single friend I know who's going through fertility treatment, which is not a great use of your time. Hello and welcome back. Thank you for sticking around to the end, and thank you so much for your time. I'm still here under the apple trees. They have like a teeny sneeze of leaves and blossom on them. But basically quite a lot of bare wood on show. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode, and I hope it might do something to lighten your panic. Thank you so much to my guests, Kat Brown and Tracy Sainsbury, for talking to me. Thank you to my producer, Rich Jarman, who has the patience of a saint. And most of all, thank you to you for listening. Next week's guest is the filmmaker, columnist, and father who gave birth, Freddie McConnell. He talked to me all about the joy of queer parenting, so please come back next Friday for that. If you've enjoyed this podcast, and actually even if you haven't, please subscribe and leave me a glowing 5-star review so more people can find it. Just leaving a 5-star review can make a huge difference. It feels great. And like manners, will cost you absolutely nothing.
This is a brand new audio production.